I think we're going to win multiple gold medals.
Ah, yes. Right.
Multiple gold medals.
Names.
Kelly Harrington is going to win gold. Paul O'Donovan, one of the best rowers in the world, and I would give us every chance of winning that.
OTB AM, weekdays from 7:30 AM. Listen on the OTB Sports app.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Ready for your next big move? The trip from the fridge to the couch. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now we're turning to Lionel Messi, who has touched down in Paris this evening. His departure from Barcelona pretty much copper fastens and puts a ribbon on their incredible decline over the last number of years. And that is something that our next guest has been investigating and writing about. And it's all part of his new book, which is published in just a couple of days now. Barca, the inside story of the world's greatest football club. Very happy to say Simon Cooper of the Financial Times is with us. Simon, was there any talk of a late name change?
It was amazing the day that the book was launched with an extract in the Financial Times. That happened in the morning, and in the afternoon, Barcelona said Messi were leaving. So it's almost like I collaborated with him to get an extra bit of buzz for the book.
Jeez, you've got your ending. I mean, you wrote there's a brilliant extract, I suppose, a slightly amended extract in the Financial Times in the last number of days. And you make the point, really, that so much of the book was about, or supposed to be about, the rise of Barcelona, and now so much of it will be about the decline and fall as well. This is one of the really staggering stories of world football over the last number of decades.
Yeah, I mean, it's the most beautiful player-club relationship, I think, in the history of football. I mean, he arrives age 13 as this undersized Argentinian kid who looks like a nine-year-old, and people are not sure he's going to be big enough to play professional football. And then he stays 20 years, he wins everything. As he said on Sunday, he's now leaving with the Catalan Argentinian children and his wife. He's grown from a child to a man there. And I think the Barcelona team of his peak years played the best football that I've ever seen and maybe that I'll ever see. And so, you know, we're now focusing on the decline, but I think the rise to greatness and the beauty that they produce is a big part of it as well. And it's easy to lay into Barcelona now and say they messed up and they mismanaged, and it's all true and they did, but they still kept the guy on board and performing for 15 years. That's never happened to a great player in the history of football before he and Cristiano Ronaldo did it.
Yeah, fair point. It'll be interesting to see if that now is just a thing that all subsequent generations managed to do through better management of players, or if there was something very genuinely freakish about Ronaldo and Messi beyond the obvious talent. Can I then lead the charge into digging out Barcelona? Because, like I said, great piece in the Financial Times over the last couple of days. And you make the point that from 2015, that night in Berlin when they won the Champions League, you say almost invisibly the club has been in free fall ever since that night in Berlin in June 2015 when it won its fourth Champions League final in 10 years. And for a lot of us, it was invisible for quite a number of years. We really have to build this story around Josep Maria Bartomeu, who we've talked about in the show before, but his reign from 2014 to 20. He was initially a caretaker when Sandro Rosell stepped down, and then there were the presidential elections maybe a month after that Champions League win in Berlin, and I suppose the euphoria around the club, the sense of maybe gratitude, however deserved or otherwise, to Bartomeu meant he won the presidential election in a landslide. Now, what a lot of us looking in who keep a vague eye on the presidential elections at Barcelona wouldn't have realised is that Josep Maria Bartomeu knew very little about football or the football business.
Yeah, I mean, it's a possessing problem at Barcelona that essentially a member of the local bourgeoisie gets elected president. There's only a kind of few men from high-class families who really can get into a position to be elected. And typically they haven't worked much in football before, and suddenly you're president and you're facing these sharks of agents, these players who are threatening to leave. And so you don't know what to do. You don't know how the thing works. And I feel bad attacking Bartomeu, partly because he was the guy who agreed to open the doors to the club to me and let me, go inside and speak to everyone. But yeah, I mean, he oversaw these terrible transfers. In 5 years, they blew over €1 billion on transfers, more than any other club in football spent in the period. And they bought players for enormous amounts, like Coutinho, like Ousmane Dembele, like Antoine Griezmann, who didn't perform, You know, when you buy a player for over 100 million euros, it should be a guarantee of quality. It wasn't. And so they ran through this money. They ended up with an aging team with the highest salaries in football. Because also the other thing that Bartomeu did is whenever Messi's dad, Jorge, came to him and said, you know, my son has a rolling contract. He's free to leave this summer. Maybe he'll leave if you don't give him more money. Bartomeu kept giving Messi pay rises. So Messi's pay trebled in the period that Bartomeu was president. And he ended up earning something like 125 million euros plus per season, salary plus bonuses. And that's about as much as a top-class team earns. That's about probably as much as the Liverpool 11 or the Bayern Munich 11 first teamers earn. And so it was just completely out of whack. And they, you know, had the highest revenues in football for a while, and they just blew it. And then when the pandemic happened, there was no buffers. There was nothing left. And so now, you know, they don't have two pennies to rub together. So, yeah, it was Bartomeu. But I think the biggest story behind it is that when you're number one, you get lazy. You stop thinking, and everyone else thinks harder. So clubs like Bayern, Liverpool, Manchester City overtook them.
Some of the detail is fascinating. So, like, for instance, again, these are the appointments that don't stop the world or change the world. But the sporting director, Adonai Zubizarreta, he had signed Neymar, he had signed Suarez, he was sacked. Bartomeu went through five sporting directors across these 6 years. This is a club you mentioned that passed on Mbappe when he was young, that passed on Haaland when he was young. And then when they sell Neymar for that 220 million, really, I mean, the Dembele and the Coutinho signings just blow that money to smithereens. The detail around the signing of Dembele is really fascinating. You might tell us about this. So this was in Monte Carlo. This is early in Josep Maria Bartomeu's tenure. So they're looking, obviously, to spend some of this money. They like the look of Dembele, and they go to Monte Carlo to meet with the agents.
Yeah, they meet the Borussia Dortmund guys in Monte Carlo, which is, of course, the place that people from the football industry go to a lot, hang out in. So you go there in your private jet. And Bartomeu and this other official are about to go into the hotel room to negotiate with the Dortmund players. And I have this from brilliant New York Times reporting. And before they go in, they agree, okay, we're not going to pay more than about 80 million euros for this kid. We got 220 million for Neymar. We've got all these revenues. We're going to pay max 80 million for Dembele. And they hug. They go into the room, and the Dortmund guys say, listen, we're not going to hang around. We got a plane to catch. We're out of here in a moment. And you have to pay essentially double that if you want Dembele. Otherwise, goodbye. Don't even negotiate. And so Bartomeu's there. He's new to the football business. What do you do? And he has all this money anyway. You know, that's the problem of being number one. You've got money coming out of your ears. Why not spend it? And so he says to Dortmund, you know, okay, yeah, let's essentially, yeah, we'll pay you what you want. And of course, you know, any young player is a gamble. Dembele doesn't live professionally. He gets injured. And Mbappe, who they could have had that same summer for slightly less money, but they didn't even reply to the agent who was offering Mbappe to them for several days. You just, in a kind of very quick, random way, in the way that you or I might say, let's go to that restaurant. No, let's go to the other restaurant. And we make the wrong choice. They made the wrong choice without thinking it through very hard. Sometimes we on the outside think that the football business is very complicated and sophisticated and cloak and daggers, and sometimes it is. But often it's just a bit incompetent.
Yeah, no doubt. So Dembele, huge mistake. 6 months later, 160 million on Coutinho, and there you have it. That's the Neymar money gone. Around that time, Messi's salary is growing exponentially, 555 million across 2017 to 21. And even somebody like Frenkie de Jong, who's a great player, and so you can't say he's a bad signing. But again, Barcelona here are in the habit of overpaying for these guys.
Yeah, so I actually thinking, you know, Frenkie de Jong, he's played about 2 or 3 months of Champions League, 2 or 3 months in the national team. He was just a sub at Ajax until a few months ago. Great if we can get 35, 40 million for him. They get lucky, Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain are bidding as well. And they're not getting Barcelona to pay 75 million euros for him. I mean, you know, he's a great player. And this is the peak of the football economy just before the pandemic. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, when Barcelona come knocking, every club raises their price. And Barcelona have learned to live with it. Because another club, even Liverpool, sometimes think, okay, we want a very fast centre forward under 25 who costs less than 30 million euros. So a club like Liverpool might draw up a list of top five forwards in that category and find out which one is the easiest to buy. Barcelona don't do that. You know, when you're number one, you go for the exact player you want. So you don't think we want a defensive midfielder a bit like Frenkie de Jong. You think, we want Frenkie de Jong. So you go to Ajax and say, we want Frenkie de Jong. We don't really have an alternative. And then, of course, the selling club just raises its price.
It seems Messi, as I suspect was the case with all the players, recognised that the quality was dipping with each passing year for all the money that was being spent. And when it was clear Neymar was open to a move away from PSG, that was something Messi put even public pressure on Barcelona to make happen. It didn't happen. To what extent, because this is often said about Messi and has been said a lot this week, you might have a feel for this, to what extent was Messi calling the shots? Like, was Bartomeu, who doesn't know much about football, very much consulting with Messi, talking to Messi? How would Messi let his demands be known? I mean, was he hanging out in the office, or was it, you know, through up the grapevine, or his father, Jorge? Tell us about the dynamic of Messi, quote-unquote, calling the shots, or otherwise, at Barcelona.
When I began writing this book, I spent a lot of time trying to understand the club as a workplace. So if the club were a bank or a radio station or a government office, who makes the decisions, who influences, how do people get on? And eventually I came to realize, look, the most powerful man inside the club is Messi. It's not that he's always at the table. It's not that he's issuing communiques. But when Messi makes it clear that he wants something, like he is happy for Tata Martino to become head coach, even though Martino has never really coached a big club before, or he really likes Tito Villanova, so Villanova's never coached a big club before, but he becomes head coach, or he doesn't want Ibrahimovic in the first team because Ibrahimovic gets in the way of his runs, or he wants Neymar back, everybody jumps. You know, so it's not that he decides, but they are always trying to keep him happy for 15 years. So they have a kind of Messi strategy, keep the kid happy. Mm. And so when Messi said in 2019, look, the biggest mistake essentially Barcelona made is letting Neymar go. He is the player I need by my side, running onto my passes. Barcelona had this dilemma because Neymar was 27 at the time, always getting injured, party lifestyle, 200 million euros. Club was already running short of money in 2019. So internally they think, no way are we going to buy this guy. It's just too much money. But they can't tell Messi that. So they spend the whole summer really pretending to buy Neymar, talking to Paris Saint-Germain, so that at the end of the summer, they can go back to Messi and say, you know, Leo, we really tried hard. We couldn't get the guy. And Messi, of course, is skeptical, doesn't really believe it. And instead, they buy Griezmann. Now, Messi had been keen on getting Griezmann the previous summer, but Griezmann had turned down Barca. Messi was a bit annoyed. So he wasn't happy about that. Griezmann was 28 years old, cost 120 million euros. So it's not that Messi makes the decisions, but Messi is heard more than anyone else. He's the most influential figure inside the club. They are always trying to make the appointments and buy the players that will keep him happy.
Simon, do you have a sense as to when some kind of panic set in about the debt and about the spiraling finances?
It's, I think, late in 2019, in 2020, in 2020, they run out of money, beginning of the year. So Suarez gets injured, Luis Suarez, they need a new center forward, but there's no money. So they try this French Congolese journeyman playing in China, Cedric Bakambu, I'd never heard of him. And then in the end, they buy another 28-year-old journeyman, Martin Braithwaite, not a Barcelona player, but he's what they can afford, they buy him. They buy this Palmeiras reserve from Brazil, amazing story, a guy called Mateus Fernandes. 10 million euros, they don't even give him a presentation, and he plays 17 minutes for Barcelona. So they're not buying at the top of the market anymore. And then they do this very complicated swap between Pjanic, they get him from Juventus, they send Otero to Juventus, essentially for accounting reasons, very complicated story, to balance their books, make the books look better. So by 2020, they're in panic. And the panic is worse because the way Spanish rules work is if it's a member-owned club like Barcelona or Real Madrid, if there are losses, then the directors are responsible for the losses out of their own pockets. And of course, the amounts have grown, so the amount of money you lose in modern football can be very big. Barcelona were looking to lose that year of the pandemic, say 200 million euros. Well, you, the president, and 15 other directors have to find 200 million euros in your bank accounts. You might have to sell your home. So they were all really panicking. And that's when, you know, the kind of roof starts to fall in, the roof of the cathedral starts to fall in, and the whole thing falls apart.
And so there ends the tenure of Josep Maria Bartomeu at 2014 to 2020. He will go down as the worst president in Barcelona's history, whether that's fair or not. And a familiar name is back, obviously. That's Juan Laporta at the helm again. Are we pretty clear that Barcelona did want to keep Messi this week? There was nothing extra they could have done or some creative accounting to keep him? Like, I mean, the suggestions have been out there, and I guess that's inevitable with a story this big, that, you know, look, Messi's calling the shots and we'd like to run this club our way and he's not getting any younger and he's going to cost us a lot of money, yeah, and all the rest of it. Were they desperate to keep him, do we know?
What was that bank of yours that went bankrupt? Was the Anglo-Irish bank?
I think we had a few, but we bailed out quite a few of them. But yeah, Anglo-Irish.
Anglo-Irish was the kind of most spectacular. Well, imagine Anglo-Irish in 2008 saying, you know, guys, you've got big financial problems, but you know what? We're going to buy Goldman Sachs. It would be a bit like that.
Simon, they may well have tried that.
They possibly tried that. And Barcelona tried to keep Messi. They tried to keep the world's best player on the world's highest salary. They halved his salary, but he's still the world's best player. So, yeah, they did want to keep him. And the presidential elections were fought on Laporta saying ridiculously that he would have a barbecue with Messi, an Argentinian barbecue and asado, and it would all be fixed. And Laporta could kind of, it was the Messi whisperer, would keep Messi. And it was just impossible. You know, if you have no more money and you want to sign the world's best player, it just doesn't work.
Right. So one last one. What do you suspect the medium-term future, say the next 5 years, holds for Barcelona, on the assumption they don't have another absolute freak generation coming through their youth academy?
They won't. There's only one generation like that in history. I mean, in 2019, when I began writing this book, the club of executives would say to me, we think we're going to become like Manchester United post-Ferguson. The Messi leaving is going to be like Ferguson leaving, and then we're going to have a period without much success. And they said, reassuringly, looking at United, United have remained in the top three or four clubs for revenues. They're still a global club. They have fans around the world, even though they don't win anything anymore. And so that would not be a terrible scenario for Barcelona post-Messi, people were saying to me. I think that's now the benign scenario. And the worst scenario is you become sort of AC Milan, Leeds United. You have more of a serious meltdown. Leeds is probably the worst case scenario.
And is that possible?
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, I mean, you know, most of their squad have no resale value. They still have no money. Even without Messi, wages are about 95% of projected revenues. A lot of sponsors are going to run away. A lot fewer tourists are going to buy seats. There's still very few tourists because of the pandemic. So yeah, I could see them having to sell Pedri, having to sell De Jong. There are very few players with high market value. You're left with some old blokes and then you become Leeds United. I don't think it will happen, but that is a possibility.
So Messi goes to PSG almost inevitably and predictably, and I'm sure there's huge excitement in Paris, where obviously you spend a lot of your time. How are PSG, who have this season signed Wijnaldum, Sergio Ramos, Pereira, they paid, you know, Hakimi, the fullback at Inter, just 60 million thrown out on him. Donnarumma, the player of the Euros. Again, quite a few of these are on free transfers, but I'm sure the salaries are high. And then, oh, Messi becomes available. Yeah, we can meet his salary demands as well, which I'm sure are significant. How are PSG circumventing financial fair play rules here? I don't understand this.
It's a good question. I mean, look, to be fair to them, as you say, you get Ramos, Donnarumma, the best young goalkeeper in the world, Wijnaldum, and the best footballer in the history of football, free transfer, €0 transfer fee. Not bad. Well done. You're paying Messi, they say, 35 million euros. So that's around a quarter of his Barcelona salary. Yeah, not bad. And to give PSG credit, their kind of squad players are not 35-year-olds without resale value like a Barcelona. A lot of clubs would like to buy players like Julian Draxler or Rafinha, or say Bernat, the left back. They have a lot of decent players. And so I think the plan is to get rid of 10 squad players who are all on high salaries as well, and you bring in three or four top players. They will get creative with financial fair play, but they've defeated UEFA on financial fair play before, and I think they're confident they can do that again with their lawyers in court.
I was interested to see what the reaction in France would be. You know, would there be this sense of, oh, come on, this is just surely not fair. Like, how can we compete? And I was kind of surprised to see the general reaction in France, and you can inform me if it's true or not, seems to be, well, a kind of grudging understanding that PSG will probably win the league anyway. So suddenly now, with Neymar, Mbappe and Messi, this is just phenomenal. And when these guys come to town, you're going to sell out your corporate boxes for treble the value if you want, and TV money's going to go, and, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. There doesn't seem to be this sense of, oh God, this is bad for the league or bad for competitiveness. There does seem to be a general reaction of, wow, this is amazing.
I mean, a couple of things. There is a lot of envy and resentment to Paris Saint-Germain, but, you know, they have been the richest club in France for about a decade now and kind of much bigger than anyone else. A couple of things. I mean, the Liga has never been one of the top leagues, as we know. So if you and I had been sitting here a decade ago and saying in a decade's time, the three best forwards in the world, you know, who will be Messi, Neymar and Mbappe, will be playing together at a French club, we wouldn't have believed it. Mm. So French football fans are just blown away. The French football has had a huge financial crisis because of TV deals collapsing. And so, you know, as you say, the TV deals around the world are going to go mega. And every stadium is going to be full when PSG come to visit. And it's just creating a huge amount of excitement. PSG didn't even win the league this past season. Lille did. Mm. So, you know, yes, I think they will. But, I mean, the dream of a French club winning the Champions League and of the club of the biggest city in Western Europe winning the Champions League, because people think that PSG is an invented club without a tradition, without fans. That's just not true. You know, I live in Paris. I know loads of people in Paris who've been Paris Saint-Germain fans since childhood. They adore Paris, especially the banlieue, the suburbs of Paris. People are mad about this club. It really lives locally. It's not some kind of Disneyland-style invention.
Is the Qatar aspect talked about much over there? Like, I must say, when I look at PSG now, part of me, and it applies to Man City, it applies to several clubs, sort of think, ugh, there's just something a little bit unseemly about this. The money being spent and also the sports washing aspect. I mean, I fully expect to see Messi holding up World Cup 2022 signs at some stage over the next year, you know, and you think of the human rights issue over there, even just with the construction debts alone. And there is obviously a very uncomfortable underbelly to this whole thing. Is that ever discussed or discussed much over in France at this stage?
It is. And a lot of people are very unhappy about it. I mean, look, I think it is hugely ugly in many ways that this country where human rights are not observed and where hundreds of construction workers have died on the World Cup, that they are, as you say, sports washing their name through this brilliant football club and players is ugly. What I'd say is, let's not blame football alone. I mean, almost all Western countries have close relationships with Qatar, with Saudi Arabia, with China, which is, you know, locking up Uyghurs in camps. And so it's sort of a bit unfair to football to say, well, football clubs shouldn't deal with these horrible regimes, but we governments and ordinary companies are just going to try and flog them our stuff and flog them our weapons all the time. And we're going to do whatever they want. And they can, you know, saw up a journalist, the Saudis in a Turkish consulate, and we'll just let it be. So I think that, yes, it is ugly, but this is a disease that goes all the way across the West, way beyond football.
Yes, it's hard to draw a line. On the footballing front then, for Messi, I'd put it to you, as upset as he was, this is actually a great deal. I mean, a great move. He could spend the next 2-3 years in Barcelona trying to keep the whole thing afloat, or he goes to PSG, doesn't have to play every game in Ligue 1. It's not necessary. He can preserve his body and rest. There's every chance he wins a Champions League or two with this ridiculous team now. I suspect he'll quite enjoy playing with Mbappe and Neymar. And, I mean, again, you park the slightly unseemly aspect we've just discussed, and you park what would have been the romantic finish at one club for his career, and there's a certain lovely symmetry to that. You park those two things, and from a footballing point of view, the next 2-3 years of his life will be a damn sight better than they would have been at Barca.
Yeah, I mean, look, Messi really, as he said at his closing press conference, he's a competitor, he's a winner. He doesn't like playing with bad footballers, and it's been very frustrating for him playing with Argentina over the years. And so I think in a football sense, he's very excited. But I think as a father, and some of you may have seen my son passing behind one of my sons, I understand that part of his disquiet is about his family. When he told his wife and three sons last summer that he wanted to leave the club, they burst into tears because his sons don't want to go to a new country and make new friends at a new school. So I think a lot of his unhappiness at the press conference, as he said, is that his family doesn't want to leave. I think if it were just him to go to Paris Saint-Germain, in some ways is a great football challenge.
Yeah. It's so interesting. It's just an incredible turnaround from 2015. That night in Berlin, watching them win that Champions League, this was just so unforeseeable. Any other overarching thoughts on Messi or PSG or Barcelona before you leave us?
I think you've drained me of all my thoughts. Well,
excellent,
done.
Excellent. So look, congrats. I know you've been working on the book for a number of years now. It's published this week, August 12th is what I'm reading. It's called Barca, the Inside Story of the World's Greatest Football Club. And I'm sure a lot of people will be digging it out. The detail in your Financial Times piece was great. So best of luck with that, Simon. Thanks so much for joining us. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Thanks.
Cheers.
That's Simon Cooper with us there, talking about Messi and Barca and PSG.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Ready for your next big move? The trip from the fridge to the couch. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
I think we're going to win multiple gold medals.
Ah, yeah. Right.
Multiple gold medals.
Name names.
Kelly Harrington is going to win gold. Paula Donovan, one of the best rowers in the world, and I would give us every chance of winning that.
OTB AM. Weekdays from 7:30 AM. Listen on the OTB Sports app.